Private on Parade is now, in this decade, is becoming one of your better known pieces, and it's often described as one of your most autobiographical pieces in that it's clearly grew out of the period after the Second World War when you were sent, is that right, to the RAF to Singapore and Malaya. What's partly striking about it is that it was originally staged, I think, in 1977. So there was a fair interval before you broached it as a subject. Was it something that was always, do you think, sort of ticking away in the back of
Yes,
your
I
mind?
think it was. And at one time I was going to write it with Charles Wood in tandem, but I've never written a play in tandem, and I don't think he has. We did talk about it, we did get so far with it, and then just simply gave it up. It did go on festering, I suppose is the way to describe it, for quite a long time, as you said, 20 years perhaps. I'd been in India for a year before that. I didn't go straight out to Singapore. It's more like Sylvia when she says in the play she was in Calcutta and she didn't like that. This is the way I've put it together. It's like a jigsaw or a collage, you know. Some of Sylvia's experiences are mine, and some of the boys are mine. And I've taken people from India, from all over the place, from my life before and after, so that it's a pudding of a play, really. And perhaps that's why I like it, because I like muddle in things.
Yes.
I was only in CSC for 8 months, and it's stayed with me until I'm now 81. And I was 18, so we reversed the 8-1-8-1-1-8, and here I am. It was, from Bristol to Bengal, you know, from Columpton to Calcutta, I mean, whatever you want to call it. It was an extraordinary break. But then it was something that most people of my age did, called up, and we went away. You know, I was luckier than my brother, for example, who went into the army, who's 5 years younger than me, and he was called up. And he only got as far as Salisbury Plain. I think that would have been miserable. I shouldn't have liked that. But I like, you know, the fact that it was horrible in many ways. Horrible, horrible, horrible. I'm writing another play now, partly, I think, as a result of having seen it at Leeds. I've been sort of stimulated to think about it and write a previous experience of the same soldier. Unfortunately, it turned out, I'm halfway through it now, suddenly it turned out, oh, he's in the Air Force in this one, and he's in the Army in France. So there may have to be a certain amount of adjustment in there, because he's a leading air craftsman and then a private. And so I'm writing that about his previous time. In India, when I was in India, I did try to get into CSC, because it existed there as well. And I went to Delhi from Calcutta to audition and was turned down. Both times, I think it was for the same show. It was to be a play called Not So Much the Heat, which I didn't write, but was a farce set in India or Singapore, I forget which, India, I think. A kind of, it ain't half hot, mum, but a farce. And, you know, the saying was, it's not so much the heat as the humidity. So it was called Not So Much the Heat. And we started, so I was turned down from that. And then I went to Singapore and got taken on for the same job. Not so much the heat, because it's going to be down there. So we just started reading it. I read it. I actually got the juvenile lead part, and Stanley and Kenneth were both in it, and we all read our parts. And then the commanding officer came in and said, "Sorry, chaps, we're going to have to scrap this show. We've had a signal from Whitehall. It's not available for production." So I assumed what had happened was that somewhere in London, somebody had taken an interest in the play. The author had sold the rights to a manager or something, and they didn't want it done all over the world, so that was it. So Stanley quickly said, "My God, we'll be returned to unit if we're not careful. Having guard duties again and horrible haircuts. Let's get a show together." So that's what we did. And that became Men of the Service. At Your Service, it was called. "We're Men of the Service, we're at your service, entertaining you," and so on.
So it was really, I mean, for you, was it an opportunity to I don't know, embrace the theatrical in a way that you hadn't been allowed to before? I mean,
Yeah, I'd been an amateur entertainer. I'd done Stanley Holloway monologues, you know, the rhymed monologues telling the story of young Albert, which were terribly popular at the time. And I put on a Lancashire accent and did that with my mother, who used to sing ballads. And something called the Bristol Wartime Entertainers, amateur concert parties that used to go out to units around Bristol. Sometimes, if we didn't have a stage, if they didn't have a big enough building for us to do the show in, we'd take the bus, and we had a bus and a coach, and at one end was a little platform and a mini piano, and obviously there were no dressing rooms, so we used to... I mean, sometimes it was raining, you know. You stand out in the rain and then go onto the stage by getting on the bus. So we did that. And sometimes there were huge, great halls full of people, Air Force or something like that, who get called into there, you know, scramble there for Freddie, you know. And then, you know, 20 chaps would get up and walk out and go to their aeroplanes and try and shoot down Jerry's. And then the others would call out, carry on. Carry on conjuring is one of the lines in Privates, which may have come from that.
And did it? So was there a faint air of the absurd surrounding most of the things then? Because to collide, I suppose, that world of music hall, review, sketches and entertainment with a pressing kind of military crisis must have been...
The crisis hadn't started. I mean, the thing was, this was a hiatus between the end of the war, the dropping of the atomic bomb, the surrender of Japan in 1945... I'm now talking about 47, strictly speaking. It's not true. I wasn't in any of these encounters with the terrorists. They'd hardly started. Mm. They were just about to start when I came home, which was in 1948. So I faked that, you know. Mm. It's telescoped and faked. Mm. I mean, people who say it's autobiographical, yes, it is to an extent. And there's only one scene in it, and really one character that's very close to life. No, two. Jenny Dennis, the old queen, is modelled on Barry Chatt, who was a civilian entertainer who wasn't in our particular party. And he was a civilian and a dancer and a drag artist. And later on, Kenneth Williams took me to see him in Boys Will Be Girls and, you know, all that sort of... You know, £10 if you can spot a girl in this show, things like that on the poster. The other one was the Sergeant Major, who was most closely modelled on our Sergeant Major, who was a corrupt and rather lecherous man who stood between the Hearties, so to speak, the sort of lorry-driving men of the unit, the electricians and so on, and us, who were the Hearties, the Hearties and the Hearties, and in the middle stood Sergeant Major Marriott, he was actually called in life, and he finished up committing suicide, taking strychnine in front of several of the members of the troop. They were all sitting around discussing football, and he mixed up some stuff, and they thought it was Epsom salts, and swallowed it down. You know, and there's not much you can do when someone takes strychnine, because he was going to be discovered by the Singapore Investigation Branch. And in my play, he discovers, he dies saying... Oh, the special investigation, but you can't really hear it in the show. There are lines specifically for him which are about that. He's been found out.
So was it right? I mean, and a rite of passage is such a corny expression in a way. But did once you come through that particular episode of your life in a way, do you think it had changed you in some way that, in terms of your understanding of the adult world that you'd now entered?
Yeah, I mean, it did. The funny thing is that I don't find that life actually exists by ratcheting, you know. Yeah. Jonathan Miller calls it ratcheting, you know, trying to describe evolution. You know, you pull up and then you pull up a bit more. I find that I slip back all the time, you know, like a bike going uphill. If you stop pedaling, you go back. So you're asking if I learned anything from it. I think I learned a lot about, you know, much more sophisticated people than I've been used to. I mean, Ken was extraordinary. Stan is still alive, and I still see him.
And, of course, when you met Kenneth Williams, would he have even a sort of fledgling fame at that point?
He may have done a bit of amateur acting, but I don't think he had. And
did you feel that he was set on becoming well-known?
Oh, yes, and Stanley. Yeah. And John Schlesinger, the film director, was in another troupe. He wasn't in our troupe at all, and he was conjuring. That was what he was doing in the shows. Stanley and Ken were... performing like comedians, like they were. I was just hanging on by the skin of my teeth because I was going to be an actor, and oh, there was no acting to do. So, but I wrote things, and when Kenneth came on his audience with Kenneth Williams on the television show, he invited us along, and I had no idea he was going to mention me. But he did, and then he started reciting an act I'd written, a solo act, sort of stand-up, we'd now call it, called The Condemned Cell, in which I began by being a sort of Count of Monte Cristo, you know, trying to get out and all that. And the troops, as intended, used to take it seriously and take the piss. And, you know, they thought they were in for a great, a long, serious monologue. In fact, they weren't at all. They were in for a lot of jokes. But by the time, the time they'd realised that, you know, they'd already fallen for it, so it was quite good.
Yeah.
And Ken took this, seemed to still have this script, or had remembered it far better than I had, forgotten all about it. But, you know, when it came back, it was bang. Oh, Christ.
Yeah. So Stanley Baxter, what was he like at that time?
Very funny, very brilliant. I mean, already a wonderful mimic. He's the only person who could do... I mean, he could do people without... You know, he could do the gesture and you'd know who he meant. You know, he could walk like Fred Astaire before you... You know, and you'd say, that's Fred Astaire, you know, and without singing a song or anything. And he was also very... almost mock serious, but serious. I mean... He was reading Sartre, you know, and that sort of thing. Just like later Ken would talk about Buxtehude and all these, you know, they were not they were not music hall comedians, you know, they were actors who happened to be comedians as well. And
so did they and did on one level, I suppose, perhaps you felt, did you feel intimidated by this sort of surprising combination of talents in one place?
I think I did in a way. But I also, what I've always had is a very easy ability to stand up and do things. I'm not, I've never had stage fright. And I've never been sort of humiliated, except when I dried, when I was a boy of 14, I dried in front of a lot of troops, an audience of troops. And I completely forgot the words, and it was rhymed verse I was speaking, so I couldn't improvise it. And I was very humiliated and went off the stage and cried. And that was, and I swore then that I would never cry again about that, you know. So, but so when I took this part on in this play that never got done, we had the reading, and Stanley and Kenneth both came up and said, you were terribly good, you know. So I was very flattered by that, and I would have been all right in it. It was just a shame that it was cancelled, you know. Then I got ill, I got amoebic dysentery, and so I missed a lot of the events that went on at CSE, including the Sergeant Major's suicide. And then I just managed to scrabble free of the hospital, my dysentery and everything else, and get on the boat to go to Hong Kong because we were going to do a date there. And when we got to Hong Kong, I got a relapse of dysentery and was in hospital again. And Stanley and Ken came to see me and brought me cakes and everything. And Stanley, as they went away, Ken told me afterwards, Stanley said, that boy will never see the shores of home again.
It was that bad. Gosh. You were
dysentery is a killer.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'd had it three times, I'd have been dead. The policy then was let you have it three times and see if you die. I think, I mean, I'm just writing this play about it, and I'm reading about the RAF strikes, which took place at the time when I was there. Mutiny, as they would call it, strikes, as we called it. The conditions were terrible, really. Yes. Food was appalling. Not in CSE. I mean, we had escaped into a sergeant's mess. So we were lucky. We didn't get paid for it, but we, you know, we had Chinese boys waited on us, and we had decent food and so on. You know, lived in a nice place.
And so combined services entertainment, as it was, as you say, a CSE was the television almost, as it were, for the troops. There was no other form of entertainment that they could unwind to.
In India we had they had some of the camps had. Cinemas, projections, you know, they projectors, and they would send out films from central office, wherever that was. Often two films together, so you'd get, you know, one reel of Brief Encounter while Celia Johnson was crying her eyes out, you'd suddenly get a bit of a Gene Kelly musical coming. Well, what, you know, because they'd sent the wrong reels. I mean, it was that sort of, it was slapstick, really. The whole thing was like silent film, really. It was grotesque. And, I mean, this one at Leeds seems to be extraordinary because it's the way it should have been done all the time. You know, it should have been done with the actors playing instruments because that looks right. Mm. They suddenly slip. You know, when I used to see it sometimes when it was first on, we had a five-piece band playing in the wings or in the pit. And I used to think, why aren't they in the play? You know, where are they? Who are they? We didn't have a band when I was in CSE. We had one pianist, and he was part of the troupe. You know, and we all knew him. He was a silly, actually. But you know, if there's a band, they're going around with the show. They're as much characters as the other people are. Anyway, you know, it's much... This is so wonderful, the way that they just... I couldn't believe it when they stopped on the first day of the reading. They read it through, and I thought, this is a cast that's so good. I would have cast them without any knowledge of their instrumental abilities. I mean, and Dennis King came up, and he and I sang the songs together. He played and I sang the songs, so we gave it a complete run through. And then the actors all, you know, were all ready for more, and they walked over to the other side of the stage and all picked up these instruments and started, you know, violin, accordion, drums, sax, trumpet, trombone, and all started playing. And I just think, you don't even notice it, do you, when you see it? I mean, I didn't even notice that they were doing it, really. It just happens. It's so natural.
When did you decide, A, to write, and B, to be a playwright?
I'd always wanted to be a playwright. And this is one thing that's been quite consistent. I only became an actor because there was no way you could become a playwright. There were no drama departments, university drama departments. There was no way you could learn, you know, about drama, except by going to a drama school and being an actor. Well, it's a pretty awful drama school, to tell you. It was Bristol Old Vic. But I lived in Bristol. I'd come out of the army. You know, the Old Vic was very reputable. Bristol Old Vic was a wonderful company. We were right opposite the stage door of the Theatre Royal. We were in an upstairs of a fruit warehouse where they were selling fruit. It was like a mini Covent Garden in Bristol. And we used to sort of climb over the sacks of potatoes to get upstairs to do our voice exercises. But we went across to the stage and went on the stage of the Theatre Royal and did exercises. We joined in. We played in the company. We played small parts in the company. Wouldn't be allowed now, but it was before Equity got onto it, you know. So they were staging these great productions of Julius Caesar with 50 extras, you know, all of them students. And so that was that. And then as I said, I got married eventually, having had a short 5-year career as an actor, on and off, and all writing all the time. Mm. And then writing in the evening when I was a teacher, which I eventually sold a play, or it won a prize. And that started me writing television. Mm. And I wrote quite a lot of television, but was never really happy with it, because I always wanted that thing of the theatre again. Big mistake. I should have stuck to it. I'd have had some money by now.
I suppose it seems almost like an act of burglary to ask how these plays actually came into being. But were you taking notes, writing, keeping notebooks?
I was keeping a diary. And a lot of it came out of the diary. I still keep the diary. Mm. I started when I was 18, and I'm still keeping it now. Yes, I think it was largely out of the diary, and I'm still doing that. I've turned my life into stage comedy. That's what I do. And I mean, that goes for Joe Egg, and it goes for privates and everything else. I mean, there have been a few, Poppy, for example, and lots of unproduced ones, which weren't based on me, weren't based on my life. Though even Poppy... You know, I did make that journey. I did make the journey from England to India, to around Singapore, and up to Hong Kong. I didn't get to Canton. But, I mean, it's the same journey, even though they took it in 1840. I think what it was that I was all the time feeling with television, though I loved cinema, I loved films, and I always have. Even more than theatre, really. But I always felt that when I wrote that I wanted that input from the audience and that direct approach. What are we doing talking to each other when we could be talking to them? Why are we pretending there's a wall between us? Why are we ignoring them or pretending to ignore them, because of course we'll wait until they've stopped laughing before we say the next line. So we are in fact conscious, acutely conscious of them. And you know, talk to any actor and say, "Oh, you know, they were terrible tonight." You know, of course, or they were brilliant tonight. Mm-hmm. In fact, they give you more reviews than you give them, I think, really.
So do you think there's a kind of so Brecht then is maybe one inspiration? I mean, who are you looking to when you were thinking that you want to be a playwright? Who were the models for you?
The models. The first model was Thornton Wilder, The Skin of Our Teeth, Our Town, all those things, which I saw was taken up. It was very interesting to find out that Michael Blakemore, Barry Humphries, people like that in Australia, right at the other side of the world, were also experiencing the same enthusiasm for Skin of Our Teeth, which was put on with Vivian Leigh, directed by Laurence Olivier, and toured Australia and came to Bristol, and we went and sat there. Vivian Leigh, what? Vivian Leigh? Scarlett O'Hara's at the Hippodrome. Hey, you know, and they all rushed along to see Scarlett O'Hara. And there she was saying, 8 o'clock and the master not home yet, and this terrific parody player, isn't it? The History of the World in Comic Strip, he called it. And had dinosaurs on the stage and people saying, you know, when the Ice Age comes, they're saying, can you please hand up your chairs, you know, and people are handing up chairs from the audience. I thought it was wonderful, you know, I thought that's what it's all about, we must do something like that. And then I lost sight of that and grew up, you know, so-called. And I guess then when I did Joe Egg, I kind of recovered it. I thought, you know, we should be doing those things, because a lot of what I saw when I was a kid weren't plays at all. I didn't see all that many plays. I saw a good deal, but mostly I saw musical variety, not musical variety.
Yeah. So you want? Did you want to write musicals then as well? I mean, was that the feeling that you could do both?
No, I didn't think I could do that. Mm. I didn't think I was capable, and I think I probably wasn't. I loved musicals, loved the film musicals, and when I was 14, 16, I don't know how old, news got round that there was a show called This Is the Army, and it was being shown in the University Theatre in Bristol, the Victoria Rooms, which was a big hall, you know, like a university hall. Mm. And I went along and went to a matinee. I don't know how I got the money, but I did. And I was absolutely pulverized, you know, I couldn't believe it. Still moved to think about it. This guy, these people came on and sang, "This is the Army," you know, with a big band in the pit. What? And it kind of blew away all the old fusty English stuff. And then a voice said, "Hello, gentlemen, Mr. Irving Berlin." The curtain went up and there he was. Irving Berlin was actually sitting there, you know, and he sang, "My British body was different as can be," etc. It was Thornton Wilder when I was young, very young. And then Brecht, when we got to the 60s, Joan Littlewood. Brecht filtered through Joan Littlewood, I suppose, really. Mm. You know, for What a Lovely War, I thought was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. I thought it was marvellous.
The first play that you saw professionally staged, what was that of yours?
Peter Pan. Mine. It was called The Hooded Terror. Again, it was a television play that I adapted for the Bristol Old Vic. It wasn't very good.
It but sounds like a melodrama, was it?
We'd now call it, I suppose, a black comedy. It was about a lot of people living in the seaside, where we'd lived in Dartmouth, in South Devon, and we'd been to a fair. And there was a man there who did a wrestling turn, and he was called the Hooded Terror. He wore a hood. You know, he did all that stuff. You know, like you hissed and booed. It was a turn, you know, really. And I imagined this man meeting some middle-class people come to the fair and going home with them, and the evening that might result from it. Mm. And the Hooded Terror was not him. He was the innocent. The Hooded Terror was their subconscious. I wouldn't write such a play now.
What's been interesting looking at Privates on Parade again is a feeling that, of course, to some extent you are a bridge back to that world of musical and Coward, even, of course, Noel Coward's brilliant pastiche in the play. So there was a feeling there and a fondness for musical revue and the form of light entertainment that began to disappear after the war. And that almost seems to have given you a sort of outsider's eye on how theatre could be. I mean, is that, do you think in a way it almost starts there with those early days in theatre and variety and so on?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you survive. I've survived. I'm 81, as I said. I suppose I've survived, generations of people who have either stopped doing it or died or, you know, gone on to do something more sensible. You inadvertently and imperceptibly grow into a different age. So I'm probably the oldest, except Peter Schaffer and John Mortimer. They're probably older than me, but in fact, I know they are. But, you know, most of them are younger than me. And I would have loved, a hugely popular writer, and it escaped me. I don't know why. And I'm an awkward case, really. I think that's really what it is.
Generally, do you get a sense of the pulse of things as they are today, and as a writer, do you think it's sort of, people talk about these times as quite dark. If you, I suppose, came out of the Second World War, it wouldn't seem so dark.
To tell the truth, I don't belong to it. Yeah. Somebody of my age said the other day, as soon as somebody starts saying, and the Olympics in 2012, they go, thank you, I shan't be here. Yeah. I mean, I may be. My mother lived till 93, so I may be. But, you know, really, I have no... Our motorway plans for 2050 are the economy in 2030. Listen, I'm 81. Yeah. So, in a way, I'm abdicating from life.